Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
Want to ease this pain? Dip it to the BC. Here's no way BCC Jesus on the email chain. Way too many threats to flee. Way too many heads to feed. Not too many beds to sleep. Chief said that it was best you leave. F you please to the refugees. And it seemed like a different other day that I've been talking to my color.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. George Watzke loves words. You can tell from the spitfire rapping and the multi-layered wordplay in his albums, which he releases under the name Watzke. This song, Brave New World, comes from his latest effort called Time's Infinity. But Watzke got his start as a slam poetry champ and has now penned a best-selling collection of essays as well. It's called How to Ruin Everything. Like his songs, Watzke's essays can be literate, pointed, poignant, or weirdly funny. Sometimes all of them at once. Today we'll get a chance to hear both his music and his written words as George Watzke has brought his band and his book to the Soundcheck studio. Let's start with a song. This is called Stick to Your Guns from Watzke, live on Soundcheck.
I'll be gone when you read this, so I just wanted to say I'm sorry to the couple decent people who got in the way. And maybe there was a point at which this all could have been different, but this is the position we're in, and it's pointless to wish it isn't. They'll all be gawking when I walk in the door, cocking my shotgun, hammering the drop to the floor. The clocks shatter, I scatter the jock horde, splatter the chalkboard. It matters a lot more than half of your thought when you were knocking me like I'm a laughing stock and a weakling, a freak and a creep. I was mocked and ignored. You're sorry now, but talk is cheap. Should have thought it before. You're the sorry flock of sheep who made me ride to the core. And of course, you'll make a break to escape through the corridor. Don't be late. I'll set you up on a date with the coroner. And our fates are sealed, all of you fakes. Don't worry, this will all be over soon. You got your finger on the trigger, kid. You got your finger on the trigger, kid. Come on, line it up, line it up, line it up. And hit me with the truth. You got your finger on the trigger, kid. You got your finger on the trigger, kid. Come on, line it up, line it up, line it up, and hit me with the truth. Thanks for tuning into the top-rated crew in the news. Feels great to us that we're the one that viewers would choose. I'm hearing through my producer, we got the scoop on the name and the favorite food of the shooter, plus an interview with the student who's been fed through a tube. She was shot in the head. We're gonna bring you a segment live from her hospital bed. We'll try to bring you the spin through your pre-existing opinions, but if we miss it, switch it to our sister network instead. Of course, we know the situation is tragic, but take a minute to appreciate our fabulous graphics. We'll be back in action with Up to the Second reports after a couple words from all our loyal sponsors, of course. So like us and vine us and tweet to connect 24/7. We're giving you what you're craving. We live to deliver live the kind of coverage that you've come to expect. We're always here for you.
You got your finger on the trigger, kid. You got your finger on the trigger, kid. Come on, line it up, line it up, line it up, and hit me with the truth.
Stick to your gun.
You got your finger on the trigger,
stick
kid.
To your gun.
You got your finger on the trigger,
stick
kid. Come
gun.
On, line it up, line it up,
stick
line it up, and
gun.
Hit me with the truth.
We come together in this hour of need to honor the innocent victims of this cowardly deed. Of course, I share your sentiment as your voice in the Senate, but let's accept nothing ever could have been done to prevent it. It's just the strange inner visions of a deranged individual, full of rage, full of hate, full of vitriol. I gotta mention that it's sick and insane. My opponent's twisting your pain for political gain.
That's lame,
and I think it's a damn shame. It doesn't give anyone power to cast blame, because the past is the past, and it's best that we keep things the same. So my Chads and my Stacys go back to the mall, fill your bags out at Macy's and chat in the hall. And I hope on that vote that you cast in the fall, cause I care for you is true.
Stick to your guns. Stick to your guns. Stick to your guns. Stick to your guns.
You got your finger on the trigger, kid. You got your finger on the trigger, kid.
That is Watsky live here in the Soundcheck studio with the song Stick to Your Guns. The most recent Watsky album is called X Infinity, so read it as Times Infinity. And George Watsky, welcome to Soundcheck. Good to
have you
here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, a big band that includes Kush Modi on bass, although he'll be playing our piano shortly, Chukwudi Hodge behind our drum kit, Pat Dimitri playing guitar, Camila Recchio on vocals, Nelly Rocha playing the cello. Hip-hop, you know, it's not unheard of, George, for hip-hop to be played with a live band, but I'm always glad to see when, you know, you can sort of recreate that studio sound live on the stage without a bunch of little black boxes.
Right on. I mean, it's something we take a lot of pride in, and this is our first tour ever using any additional tracks to beef up the set, and it's only because we have lighting that's traveling with us for the first time, but we've been very steadfast about playing live, having it be a live band feel, and not, you know, bringing anything in that's being piped in from anywhere else.
Right. Now, that song, Stick to Your Guns, you know, it's a song about gun violence, but it's a song that approaches gun violence from several different angles, which also gives you a chance to take on media and social media and politics and things like that. It's almost like an essay unto itself.
Yeah, well, that was the first time I've ever written a song by taking each verse from a different perspective. And I wrote it in a period in October where there had been a whole string of shootings. I mean, it just seems like every week there's another one, and that's something that's played out my entire young adult life, and it makes me angry, and I think it should make people angry that basically that song doesn't encapsulate a single incident, but it's archetypal of so many things that happen again and again, and the fact that this pageant plays out with such predictability that it's relevant to almost every past shooting that's happened and all the ones in the future that we can almost grimly anticipate are going to happen.
Yeah. So it reminds me a little bit of the Bob Dylan song All Along the Watchtower, where each verse is from a different perspective. You know, it's a different point of view. And mentioning Dylan, you know, he, of course, just got the Nobel Prize for Literature. And it got a lot of people talking about the distinction, if any, between lyrics and poetry. Now, someone who started with slam poetry and now does both, do you find that there's a... do you know when you've crossed the boundary from one into the other?
I think those boundaries are artificial. There were a lot of pieces. I remember a couple days ago reading the New York Times opinion pieces, and some were really celebratory, and then there was an op-ed that said Dylan shouldn't have gotten the Nobel Prize because it's a slap in the face to real writers who bust their ass, you know, on the page. And my opinion is firmly in the pro-Dylan Nobel Prize camp. I think that if you are writing lyrics, they are poetry, and poetry is literature. So I think those distinctions are created, and I'm very happy he won that award. I think it's great to legitimize the art of writing lyrics. Mm-hmm. And that if we do raise that art form up, then more people are going to take it seriously as a craft.
Well, my take on it was, you know, we've been writing songs for as long as we've been writing epic poems, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid. Those were all sung, you know? So the idea that this is literature, not a new idea.
No, yeah, definitely. But I was excited by it, and I think that it just goes to show that people, you know, who put care into their lyrics are going to be rewarded. And for rap music, there's so much amazing poetry in music these days. And you look at like Kendrick Lamar and Chance the Rapper and some of the most amazing lyrics that have been written in the history of hip hop. So I'm really excited about the age of music that we're in right now. There's diversity, and it means good and bad, but a lot of good.
Yeah. There's also a diversity of approaches to rap. I mean, there are, you know, certain rappers who are always kind of, they have a kind of a slower liquid flow behind the beat. And then there are other people who are, you know, this kind of rapid fire submachine gun spatter of lyrics. You seem to be able to do both.
Yeah, I've heard some people describe it as jack of many trades, master of none. My opinion on it is that I just love a lot of different things. Like, I like storytelling. I like lyrical gymnastics. I fell in love with hip hop for a lot of different reasons. And I like to be able to play in different forms. It's boring to me to try to find one song structure that works and just recreate that over and over again. And some of my favorite artists are the ones that take big risks and they keep reinventing themselves artistically because they get true joy out of the process of discovery and creation. And that is exciting to me, is to not know whether you can pull something off and to to leap into it. So my albums are kind of all like that. A little bit of narrative, a little bit of just verbal rapid fire stuff. You got humorous stuff, more introspective stuff, some stuff that crosses in between. And I tell people like that if they follow my music, it's like the weather in Boston. Like, I want them to expect the unexpected. And if they don't like the song that I'm giving them at any time, don't worry. It's going to be really different the next time they change the track.
Yeah. So just a kind of a technical question. The faster songs, you know, when you have this kind of rapid fire patter, mm-hmm. You know, it can obscure the words. And words are clearly very important to you. So how do you... There's a tension. There's a kind of a creative tension when you make a decision to go that route.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think it depends who's listening to, because for me, I was raised on like really fast, rapid fire lyrics. And so when someone has clear diction and is like really spitting their words out in a way that you know, they're wrapping all their tongue around everything, I can understand it usually first or second lyric listen if it's like a guy like Eminem or Tech N9ne or something who take a lot of care to make sure that they're crisply delivering their lines.
Right.
My dad, for instance, he thinks that he's making the opposite point. He wants it on the page every time after I show him a song. He says, all right, that's great, but can you print the lyrics out and give them to me? I like thinking that it's got high replay value so people can listen a bunch of times and keep finding new stuff, and that I take a lot of pride, like I said, in the diction and the clarity, so that if people go back and listen, even if they can't digest the density of the words the first time, they'll find the nuance to it the second, third time around.
All right. Now, you sing as well. In fact, there are even some occasional songs where there's no rapping, where you just sing all the way through it. On the new record, Chemical Agent is mm-hmm. an example. And you mention in one of the essays in your book, How to Ruin Everything, you mention your record collection, a collection of alt rock, you know, alternative rock from mm-hmm. the 90s and stuff. Was there ever a thought in your mind that you might go that route?
No, because I'm not a good enough singer. And it's actually, Bob Dylan is just an inspiration in so many ways to just inspire people who don't have traditionally good voices yep. to say you can be a singer. And something that I talk to Koosh in my band about a lot, and Max, who plays with us, Max Miller-Lauren, is that a voice doesn't have to be traditionally virtuosic to be good to listen to. And my voice is, I'm sure there's ways if I took more lessons I could be a better traditional singer, but it is what it is, and I try to embrace it. I'm trying to get better and learn to hit pitches and put more character into it. So I think people like hearing, especially in rap, I like hearing the rappers sing their own choruses a lot, even if they don't sound like Adele or Michael Bublé or something. So I like doing it. I like
especially if
the
they don't sound
especially,
like Michael
especially, yeah,
Bublé.
That might be a knock against them. So I try. I'm not a naturally, you know, virtuosic singer, but I love to just mix it up. And like I said, Bob Dylan, hey, guy who made Lemonade.
Yep, yep. We're speaking with George Watzke, and so far talking mostly about the most recent album, Time's Infinity, the latest from Watzke, but there is also the matter of the book, collection of essays, which I want to talk to you about, George, in a couple of minutes. But first, this next song you're going to do for us has a musical relative on the new record, but you're going back to the kind of second generation of this song. Tell us a little bit about Tiny Glowing Screens.
So this is the second part in a series that started on my album Cardboard Castles, and Koosh Modi produced the song. I wanted to do this one because I wanted people to get a sense of the different sort of layers of what I do. The first one was a straight-ahead song, mm-hmm. and the next thing I'm going to do is an essay collection that's more just straight-ahead prose, but this lies somewhere in the middle. It's a spoken word piece that's set to music.
All right. I think we're ready to hear it. So this is Watzke with another live performance here in the Soundcheck studio. The album is called Time's Infinity. This song is on the previous record called Cardboard Castles. It's called Tiny Glowing Screens, Part 2.
There's 7,046,000,000 people on the planet, and most of us have the audacity to think we matter. Hey! Hear the one about the comedian who croaked? They stabbed him in the heart. Just a little poke. But he keeled over because he went into battle wearing chainmail made of jokes. Hey! Hear the one about the screenwriter who passed away? He was giving elevator pitches and the elevator got stuck halfway. He ended up eating smushed sandwiches they pushed through a crack in the door, repeating the same crappy screenplay idea about talking dogs till his last day. Hey, hear the one about the fisherman who passed? He didn't jump off that ledge, he just stepped out into the air and then pulled the ground up towards him really fast. Like he was pitching a line about fishing for concrete, the earth is a drum and he's hitting it on beat. The reason there's smog in Los Angeles is because if we could see the stars, if we could see the context of the universe in which we exist, if we could see how small each one of us really is against the vastness of what we don't know, then nobody would ever audition for a McDonald's commercial again, and then where would we be? No frozen dinners and no TV, and is that a world we want to text in? Either someone just microwaved popcorn, or I hear the sound of 1,000 people pulling the heads out of their asses and rapid succession, the people are hunched over in Boston. They're starting screen printing companies and app stores in San Francisco. They're grinning in Los Angeles like they got fish hooks in the corners of their mouth. But don't paint me like the good guy, cause every time I write, I get to choose the angle that you view me and select the nicest light. You would not respect me if you heard the typewriter chatter, tap, tap, tapping through my mind at night. The same stupid tape loop of old sitcom dialogue and tattered memories of some girl I got to grind and in high school filed carefully on rice paper. My heart is a colored pencil, but my brain is an eraser. I don't want a real girl, I want a tracer from a catalog. Truth be told, I'm unlikely to hold you down, cause my soul is a crowded subway train and people keep deciding to get on the next one that rolls through town. I'm joining a false movement in San Francisco. I'm frowning and hunched over in Boston. I'm grinning in Los Angeles like I got fish hooks in the corners of my mouth, and I'm celebrating on weekends because there are 7 billion 47 million people on the planet, and I have the audacity to think that I matter. I know it's a lie, but I prefer it to the alternative. I got a tourniquet tied to my elbow, I got a blunt wrap filled with compliments and I'm burning it. You say go to sleep, but I've been bouncing off my bedroom walls, and that was hecka small. We're every agent wants it tucked inside ourselves like Russian nesting dolls. My mother is an 8-year-old girl. My grandson is a 74-year-old retiree whose kidneys just failed, and that is the glue between me and you. That is the screws and nails. We live in a house made of each other, and if that sounds strange, that's because it is. Would somebody please freeze time so I can run around turning everyone's pockets inside out? And remember, you didn't see shit.
Watsky, live on Soundcheck with Tiny Glowing Screens Part 2. Parts 1 and 2 are both on the album Cardboard Castles, which came out about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. right, George?
2013.
And Part 3 is on the new record called Time's Infinity. Watsky is performing here in the studio, George Watsky and his band. And, George, that song actually is a very kind of a neat segue into talking about the book. Because there's a moment in the song where you talk about how you're presenting yourself, you know, and I give you the best part of me, you know, don't expect that that's the real me, because you mine a similar territory in your introduction to the book,
mm-hmm.
saying it's like, if I come across as a good guy, remember, I'm writing this,
yeah.
which is kind of a neat way of, I don't know, of working at two levels of meaning at the same time, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a little bit. It's hard to win that battle, because if you're trying to present yourself as a nuanced, flawed person, then someone says, oh, wow, he's so relatable because he's presenting himself as nuanced and flawed. What a great guy. So it's really hard to kind of catch your tail in that thing. But I do try and let people know over and over again, I am striving to be a good person, but every one of us is fucked up. And, you know, I think trying to present those parts of yourself is what being an artist is about.
Yeah. Now, the book is called How to Ruin Everything. And right away, you know, you talk about how this is a book ostensibly about failure. But then you get into that kind of, you know, the serpent eating its own tail thing, because failing is trying, and trying is a form of success. And
yeah.
So failing to fail is kind of what you've done here.
Yeah. I tried to get them at Penguin to let me use their classics cover, because they have this very iconic orange cover that's got a band running through it.
Right.
And I wanted them to let me use their, like, you know, the one that they use for Aristotle and Shakespeare and stuff, but then have like just a coffee mug stain on the front of it. But I guess legal got it. I wasn't really that into that idea.
So, you know, we were talking before about, you know, do you know when you've made the transition from poetry to lyrics, and you were saying how you feel that's kind of a fluid and artificial boundary. What about the boundary between spoken word and the written word?
Well, I mean, between all those things, at least in terms of my own work and creative process, the boundary is more formal. And I don't mean formal like, you know, suit and tie. I mean like in terms of the actual structure of it, because most of my songs, traditional songs on my album, are written in the chorus, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus format with 16 bar verses. I mean, there's exceptions all over the place of verse length and stuff, but I'm writing it with end rhymes and internal rhyme schemes and melodic choruses and stuff. The spoken word, however, I write more like an essay in terms of a linear stream of consciousness thought process, and there's no bar form barriers that, like for Tiny Glowing Screens Part 2, for instance, I didn't structure it at all. It's just floating free form over the beat. And then with an essay, there's no music at all, and I'm only focusing on the experience of someone reading it on the page. I'm imagining that they're going to have time to return to a sentence multiple times. So they're, for my writing, there's a lot of like dependent clauses. Mm-hmm. They're pretty long sentences. It's stuff that I don't do in some of my music and poetry because I'm writing for someone who only may get one listen to it, even if they could go back for the density of it. I'm assuming that, you know, I get the free range to have a little more density in my narrative writing. And in this book, I tried really hard for the story to be front and center, and that the pontificating happened as a result of the actual story I was telling, not just me going off and, you know, having a tangential, long philosophical argument that didn't have anything to do with the story. I want people to really be able to follow the narrative.
Right, which is a, you know, kind of autobiographical, chronological narrative. You know, you do, it's not scattershot that way. The essays all kind of follow each other. Who or where were these originally written for?
I started writing prose without an intention of having it published. There were certain stories and things that I found compelling to write about that didn't fit into the structure of a poem or a song, and I figured I might find a home for them later. And then the opportunity to get a book deal came up, and I thought that this would be a great opportunity for me to sort of crack the door to a bunch of other things I'd like to do down the line. It's close enough in terms of it being autobiographical to my spoken word that I thought a publishing company and my fans might be able to wrap their head around me doing it and not sucking. Because if I came out of the gates with a novel, I thought people might not take me seriously as somebody who really put care into it. But that if they liked this, that that might be close enough to a novel next time that I can write a weird science fiction book and people might say, oh, you know, let's really give it a read as a serious project, not just as like a passion project of a musician who wants to spend 2 months doing something kooky.
Well, this seems like it was more than 2 months worth of work.
Yeah, it was.
Can you pick an essay for us and give us a taste of what's in the book? The book is called How to Ruin Everything, Essays by George Watzke. What do you want to read for us?
I'm going to read an abridged chapter called What Year Is It? This is What Year Is It? It's hard to tell what year it is in Heimpom. There's a homemade suspension bridge there, deep in the coastal range pines of Trinity County, 100 miles from the Oregon border, 3 winding hours from the nearest city of Redding, California. You still can't get internet or phone service, although my Aunt Marion says that 2 miles up the road, you might get a signal by a tree with a sign nailed to it with cell scrawled in capital letters. The bridge itself is 100 yards long, its twin coiled suspension wires grinning as it dangles its 380, I counted, slats of graying 2x10s from identical wooden towers on each side of a bluff above the South Fork of the Trinity River. My Uncle Jack, Marion's husband, designed it with a friend from UC Berkeley while he was holed up in the mountains in 1973. He'd made the mistake of finishing architecture school with Vietnam still burning, lost his student draft exception, and heard his number called. And that summer, my mom, her sisters, and their friends helped build it from Jack's plans, one board at a time. Lying on my back, bobbing up and down in the deep swimming hole under the bridge, I can't believe how permanent it looks, silhouetted against the blue sky. How trustworthy. How safe I feel walking over a structure nailed together by a bunch of 20-somethings more than 40 years ago. There's a rock carving of an owl's face near the abandoned chicken coop next to the house, just across the bridge. Before I came down to the swimming hole, I saw it leaning against the rickety tool shed and remembered Uncle Michael chiseling it during a family reunion. I recalled marking his progress and making suggestions on how to improve the shape of the beak as we traded insights like two old artistic colleagues. So I was taken aback when I saw July 1993 carved under the owl's face. Definitely a mistake, since that would have made me 7 at the time. Impossible, I insisted to my parents. Yeah, well, I still see myself as the 20-year-old who built that chicken coop no matter how old I get, my mom replied. What year is it? A voice asks faintly. I'm lying on my back, bobbing up and down as overhead fluorescence race by. How many fingers am I holding up? I puzzle, a mess of digits advancing out of the fog toward me. That's a tough one. 2? Good job, buddy. Now, can you tell me what year it is? No, I realize. No, I can't. We have to give him a spinal tap, the doctor declares, jogging alongside my rolling bed, in case it's meningitis. 2001, I recall, suddenly motivated. I look down to see myself wearing my navy and gold San Francisco Unified School District gym uniform, an IV in my arm, knees scraped and bloody, thighs spotted with fresh bruises. The fog gives way to a searing migraine. My jaw muscles are locked, the sides of my tongue chewed meat, burning as I probe my mouth to find slices of dead skin hanging on the inside of each cheek. The last thing I remember is running the mile in gym class, the official one that determines whether or not George W. Bush will mail me my coveted fitness certificate with the sweet gold foil stamp on it. I remember pumping my legs as hard as I could, making my hands sleek and aerodynamic, desperate for the athletic approval of a president my city despises. I don't remember finishing. Waking up from a seizure is a bit like being born. Everyone else runs around the hospital freaking out, but you've slept through all the drama. You open your eyes to a world you can't make sense of. Information comes slow until, out of the mist, a faint voice asks what year it is, and before you can come up with the answer, you conjure your first word. Fuck. Then think, not again. The first one was the scariest. Each that followed more routine. The odds of having a seizure are pretty low at any given time. But floating alone at the swimming hole, it does cross my mind. It's always in the background. No one would hear me. Mom and Dad and Aunt Marion wouldn't figure it out for hours. I just feel a little copper taste in the back of my mouth, that warm weightlessness, soak up one fading view of the summer of 1973 silhouetted against the sky, and no one would ever ask me what year it is again. It's a self-indulgent thought, but it builds a bridge to my parents in my mind. Their jokes about aging and AARP memberships are getting a little more morbid and a little less funny. The truth that anyone can die at any moment, including me, including right now, makes me feel as though our conversation up at the house wasn't just between parents and son, but colleagues. What age do you see yourself as, Dad? I'd asked him next to the owl. Ah, the continuity theory of personal identity. Jesus Christ, I'd immediately regretted asking. I'd have to say in my early 30s, he paused. You know, maybe it sounds silly, but I still feel like I have these endless possibilities in front of me. It doesn't sound silly to me, I replied. My toes peek from the pond surface as I catch a flicker of green out of the corner of my eye. I flip over and see a floating grasshopper the size of a Pez dispenser kicking violently, and remember hearing something in a science class I dozed through years ago about how water strips the scales off insect wings. I splash over to the bank and grab a sheet of loose shale under the rock and ferry him to shore, where he sways back and forth on six wiry legs bent impossibly at the knee, folded against leaves that aren't leaves at all, but somehow his wings, his frame's fluorescent green popping against two beady red pinhead eyeballs, staring in 1,000 different directions at once, at least one of them back at me, the sun drying my shoulders. 2 weeks from now, the worst forest fires in decades will rage across the Trinity Alps, turning acres of century-old pines to spent matchsticks. Marion and Jack will stay in the cabin to clear brush and see their old place for the last time. Everyone in our family will cry and wring our hands and wonder how we'll cross the river next summer with the bridge turned to cinder, or if we'll be back at all. But then, for no good reason, the 50-foot flames will die just at the base of the hill in retreat, and by some lucky whim of nature, the house in Heim Palm will stand to see another summer.
George Watzke reading from his book called How to Ruin Everything, a series of essays, and that chapter about dealing with epilepsy goes through a number of kind of cycles of seizure and recovery and ends with the building of the bridge. So you said before it's not formed like a song, but that chapter almost is in the way that it kind of recapitulates.
Right on. Yeah, I tend to do that a lot. Go back to the beginning and things, and in several of my albums, that's a device I use as well.
But the new record too, right? There's a reprise at the end of the album.
I try not to do it all the time because I really love David Sedaris, and he has a whole essay where he talks about how bookending essays is kind of corny, I mean he does it too, but you have to use the device sparingly because it's so tempting to do.
Your dad sounds like a pretty awesome guy.
I love Paul Watzke. I love Claire Watzke, too. I have a very strong relationship with both my parents, but my dad and I have a lot in common, and he's a poet and a baseball lover and a very sweet, awesome dude.
Right. Yeah. One of my favorite essays in the book is about you and your dad and the love affair with the San Francisco Giants. And
rest in peace, our 2016 season.
Yeah. So what do you do now? If you and your dad are true baseball fans, does that mean you're rooting for the Cubs at this point?
Oh, the minute we got knocked out, I was rooting for the Cubs. The only reason that I have not to root for the Cubs is because I like the idea of a team that strives. You know, as soon as the Cubs win the World Series, the magic of them ever winning again will be gone.
Yeah.
And they are the last team that has that. The Red Sox, Pat, our guitar player, is a Red Sox fan. The Red Sox winning the World Series for the first time in what was it, 2004?
Yeah.
Was the most magical moment I'd seen in baseball, even though the 2010 one for the Giants winning was more affecting to me emotionally. We'll never get another Red Sox World Series victory like that. We're only going to get one amazing Cubs victory. And I'm hoping, because the Game 7 World Series night falls on the night we play Chicago. So,
wow.
If the Cubs take it to 7 and we get to rage in Chicago for the Cubs, I know Cootie's like putting his hands up. Please, baseball gods, give us that moment. I would love to party with Chicago. It's a great thing for a city to experience that.
Yeah. Well, and they'll be facing whoever gets there.
The Indians.
Cleveland.
They've clinched it, yeah.
Who've had a long wait themselves. I mean, no one talks about it because the Cubs has been over a century, but Cleveland's had a pretty long drought as well.
Put it this way, the movie Major League came out to make fun of how bad Cleveland had been for so long, a long time ago, and they've sucked still ever since then. So it's going to be a real, real tragedy for those two teams to face each other in the World Series.
Yeah, well, let's hope that that happens.
Yes.
Cubs still have some work to do. The new Watzke record is called Times Infinity. Again, that's spelled with an X, X Infinity. The book is called How to Ruin Everything. And I guess the piece that we're going to hear next sort of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. This is one of the fast, you know, on your part, mm-hmm. George, a really fast bit of kind of vocal leisure domain. Opera singers come in here and they talk about the kind of exercises that they do to maintain, you know, serious singers talk about their instrument the way athletes talk about their balls and their mitts and their, you know, their gear. Do you have to do anything special to be able to kind of maintain the flow and the diction and all the things you were talking about before?
My practice is basically that we have 6 shows a week for months at a time when we're on tour. So I have my paces that way. And when I go off the road for a long time, I need to sort of get back into shape. I think there's 3 main things that allow me to do this for people who aspire to do this kind of rapping or spoken word or anything. One of them is diction. And you could do theater tongue twisters to help you with your diction. Another one is rhythm. And I was a percussionist. And so studying and being able to break down stress patterns and syllables is really important. Be able to be very precise, because precision in it sort of creates the illusion of it being faster and having the stress patterns be really on. And the last one is breath control. So anytime you have an opportunity to take a breath, you need to take it, because it's like eating in the desert. You know, if you have a 16th note rest, you need to breathe as much as you can on that rest to fill you up, to make sure you can push solidly through the end of the line.
Yeah. So there's a real kind of virtuosity of, you know, perhaps not the traditional sense of like, wow, this guy is hitting high C's or, you know, these incredible runs of notes. There's a very different kind of athleticism and virtuosity involved in this.
Oh, man, there's stories about Outkast practicing in the early days, running around the block, and their manager would make them put on sweatsuits and do their verses literally like running around the street over and over again to make sure they were building up lung capacity.
Right,
so, yeah,
right.
100%.
All right. Well, all of that comes into play in this song, which is a really beautiful piece called Talking to Myself. And once again, George Watzke on vocals with Camila Recchio on backing vocals. Kush Modi is at our piano. Chukwudi Hodge behind our drum kit. Pat Dimitri playing guitar. Nelly Rocha, the cello. This is from the new record called Times Infinity. Here's another live performance from Watzke of the song called Talking to Myself.
When
day you opened up your eyes inside of you, inside a world, inside a universe. You didn't get to choose. You didn't get to pick the rules or pick the past or set the pace or cast the casting crew. You didn't get to pick your starting place. And though it was a race you didn't understand, you simply lined up on the blocks. And when the pistol popped, you ran. And when you tripped and dropped, you picked yourself up off the ground and picked your scabs and knew you had to pick a plan to end what you began. As you got older, there were days of cold surrender, days of shrugged whatever is folded in with days of shocking splendor. But as time advanced, the lovely days were covered up from view by an advancing melancholy haze that hovered near the dew. Yet there were moments. There were these pure resting moments when you stepped outside your head, outside control, outside the pain, outside the bullshit, out of body, out of rage, outside the need to get it, you will never get it, that's okay.
Have you felt a little off today? Had a lot to say, but wound up talking to yourself. I've been hunting for a kindly ear, but couldn't find one near, and wound up talking to myself.
Had a little spot where you've been going through a lot. Wanna shove it to the bottom, but a trouble gonna bubble to the top. Then the bubble gonna pop, and the hustle never ever gonna stop. Cause you could have been the more to get ahead, to get to bed, and then you do it all again until the moment that you drop. You need a plot, what you wanna witness with this life you got. You kicked it far, trying to get up in your skin and pick this lock. That ticking clock, listen to the bitch, you got these situations which you issue. Someone fit too quick, shit, sit you down and talk. Never wonder who's the crazy one. People walking to work cause then nothing is off. But if a person really got it, they would be cracking a bottle and somebody said it looting from shops. Other times you're alone, no one, nobody's home, but you walk around muttering under your breath, second guess it, just say, yeah, goddammit, 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 just whispering soft. Do you ever get lost deep in your thoughts, triple when you think about the cost of seeing this through, when you take a stomach in a notch that you don't know how to undo? But do you ever have another moment after that when you can see there's no one way this has to be? Or maybe that's just me.
Have you felt a little off today? Had a lot to say, but wound up talking to yourself. I've been hunting for a kindly ear, but couldn't find one near, and wound up talking to myself.
That's Watsky with Talking to Myself. You'll find a version of that on his most recent album, Time's Infinity, but that's another live performance from George Watsky and the band. They've been playing for us here in the studio this afternoon. And George, just real quick, I want to just pick up on a thread that you dropped a few minutes ago. Do you have a novel in mind? Is that the next step?
Yeah. It's like science fiction that covers 600 years, and I'm trying to sell my publisher on the idea of it being a really smash success. It's going to be great. They want another essay collection, but
well,
science fiction book.
Well, you got lots of fans for the videos, the songs, the essays, so, you know, good luck with the I would read it.
Thank you. And thanks for having me. This was awesome.
And let me just say a quick thank you and goodbye to longtime Soundcheck producer Dan O'Donnell leaving us today.
Whoa.
He has been propping up this enterprise for a couple of years from behind the scenes and is off to pastures, or in this case, podcasts new. Dan, thank you very much. This is Soundcheck.
My doctor says I'm being reckless. That quitting's risky for my health, and I fuck up my life real bad. But if I had to choose, I know I'd rather lose my life than have to lose myself.
That'll do it for this edition of the Soundcheck podcast, but as always, there's much more to be found on our website. Lots of other live performances, video shot in the studio, our daily gig alerts, our weekly music roundups, and more. Check it out at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.
Already saved. I'd like us to spend some alone time. Just you and me. But if I slide into a zone...